How do you define femininity? Is it the biological functions unique to women, like menstruation, childbearing, breastfeeding? Is it behavior patterns, like being nurturing, maternal, healing? Or is it something more cosmetic, like pastel-colored dress emphasizing a little bit of cleavage, or high heels that accentuate the shape of the legs, lipstick to dramatize the fullness of the mouth, all insinuating a core of sensuality and vulnerability? Or is it emotional? In the 1970 Broverman and Broverman study, a group of psychologists rated these characteristics as feminine. Cries very easily, very emotional, very excitable in a minor crisis, very illogical, and very easily influenced. Susan Brownmiller has written a new book titled Femininity, in which she examines the aesthetic that we've defined as feminine, explores its origins, and suggests its implications for the women who design their bodies and behavior to fit into it. Susan Brownmiller's first book, Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape, is one of the classic books of contemporary feminist analysis. It was the first book to propose that rape is an act of violence, not an act of lust. Brownmiller is a founding member of Women Against Rape. This group opposes pornography, which portrays acts of violence against women as sexually arousing. Her new book, Femininity, is published by the Linden Press. Susan Brownmiller, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry Gross. I'm pleased to be here.
What does femininity mean to you? It's a hard question to start with. Should we move right on?
Can we
from
move
there?
On to you? Well, what's your second question?
Yeah. You define femininity as an aesthetic, and I've never heard it put quite that way before.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I define it as exquisite aesthetic. One that I must say I have internalized as much as any woman, and one that I've struggled to achieve and match all of my life, even as I chafe under its restrictions, even as I attempt to analyze what it does that impedes progress, that constricts and restrains. I'm still impressed with it. I really am. I also define it as a nostalgic tradition of imposed limitations. I see the limitations. I also see the romance of it at the same time. It's awfully complicated, and it was fun to explore. It really was.
Do you think that we're in a period where there's a return to femininity as it's been classically defined?
Yes. No doubt about it. When I started this book in 1977, there was no return to femininity. And I thought perhaps I was even analyzing a passing phenomenon. Interesting, quaint perhaps, and certainly nothing we have to be that concerned about today. But 2 years into this book, I looked around me and I saw the return. I mean, maybe because I was studying it, I was super sensitive to it, but, oh, you couldn't miss it. I mean, you couldn't walk down the street and not see the women in the high-heeled shoes, the return of cosmetics. Friends of mine who swore they would only wear pants for the rest of their lives were suddenly back in dresses. Newspaper article after newspaper article about baking pie crusts from women who had wanted to win Pulitzer Prizes a few years before. Now they were talking about the joys of homemaking. On a more serious level, the intense kinds of conversations I would hear among my friends who felt that the biological clock was running out, and they wanted to experience that part of them that was female. See, I don't call that feminine. I call it female. The experience of having a child and raising that child. The desperate search for a man. And as I see it, there are very few men around. So that's why the search is so desperate. The going to the gym, you know, not in the name of good health, so, you know, physical strength so much as slimming down, diet, the obsession with diet that seems to have overtaken the nation. Yes, all those things seem to add up to a return to femininity.
Why is it happening?
Well, I think that the two big reasons are shortage of men and shortage of jobs. In the 70s, and we feminists certainly contributed to it, there was a tremendous raising of the expectations of all women. And as it's interpreted today by, say, Helen Gurley Brown in Cosmo, have it all, go for it. All those phrases, have it all and go for it. You know, women, the world is your oyster. You've got nothing stopping you except some old hang-ups. Just go out and get it all. I think that's a snare and a delusion, and I think that most women have come to understand that it is quite hard for most of us to have it all. Maybe there are some super achievers who can succeed on all fronts. I'm not one of them. But I have chosen to succeed on the front that interests me the most, to write books that I think are serious books.
Why would a shortage of jobs and men lead to wearing high heels and makeup and dresses as opposed to pants?
Because, Terry, I think when life and liberty get too tough for women, they resort to age-old strategies of survival. Femininity is a survival. I mean, of all the definitions, I suppose if you need one sentence, if I was only allowed one sentence, I'd say it's a survival strategy and it's a very competitive survival strategy. Femininity is women competing with women for the approval of men. Yeah. And who is to blame? Who is to blame? I mean, I don't blame men. I don't blame women. I'm just noticing that this is what it is. And, you know, if you look at the animal world, and I spent a lot of time, you know, looking at studies of primates and lower species, anthropologists and zoologists talk a lot about male-male competition for access to females. I mean, the Darwinian view of evolution, in fact, is all these males competing with each other for women, for females, and for scarce food resources, which is the equivalent, I guess, for us of the job. That is not the human experience. I mean, in human society, what I see is females competing with females for access to males. I mean, it's a quite unusual reversal, and the way we compete is to out-feminine one another, and that mission includes the displays of vulnerability, submissiveness, the need for protection. It's a funny kind of competition, isn't it?
You gave up a lot of the feminine ways of looking, cosmetics and dresses and high heels and those things.
Yeah.
When you became a feminist and started thinking about feminist analysis and feminist history, mm-hmm. Why did you give that up? And why haven't you joined other people in returning to it?
Well, I'm still in conflict, and I always have been. I gave it up because I was pushed into giving it up. Truly, I will tell you this. In 1970, I led the sit-in at the Ladies' Home Journal. It was the first sit-in in the history of the new women's movement. And we got 200 women. A lot of them were college women at the New York City schools, Barnard and Columbia, Hunter. 200 women sat in at the Ladies' Home Journal. I led this action. It was my action. I was so proud of it. I wore a dress because in 1970, I was still wearing dresses. And I remember the dress I wore. It was sleeveless. It was sort of like the Jackie Kennedy look, you know, a little A-line. It had a designer label. It was a Jacques Tiffaut. It was gray. I wore my little pearls with it. I think I wore my Gucci shoes with it. I think my hair was probably done in 1970. What happened was that these younger women in the room had trouble relating to me. You know, I was so busy relating to the editors at the journal. See, I'm a feminist, but I look like you. And my very own women had felt that I didn't look like them. And even though I had worn skirts and dresses all my life, I looked around at these younger women and thought, oh, if I am going to be a movement leader, I better get into a pair of pants. Fast. I didn't know how to dress in pants either because I had grown up in the 50s where we only wore skirts. So I tried some jeans. People who knew me then said I was my jeans were too short. I didn't know how to dress in pants. Anyway, once I got into them, you know, I liked them. It was terrific. It was fun. I could stop shaving my legs. For the first time in my life, you know, I didn't have to worry about a clean-shaved leg and nylon stockings. I was free. And I thought I'd never return to skirts, and I must say I haven't. But I must say that I think there are fewer of us still wearing pants exclusively. And that's why when I wrote my chapter on clothes and I found the history of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucy Stone and how they struggled to wear the bloomer costume from 1850 to 1852 and couldn't take the pressure, could not take that psychological pressure. They were laughed at, scoffed at, called women who wanted to be men, and all they wanted was to wear a comfortable costume. And they gave it up. And I cried, you know, when I wrote that section of the book, of my book. I mean, I found those documents and wrote it up in my own language and reread it. I burst into tears because I felt that that's what was happening again today. I feel terrific in pants. I don't want to be the only woman wearing pants. I'm scared. Sometimes I think I'm going to be the only one still wearing pants, the only one who isn't shaving her legs. Other women sometimes say to me, why do you why torture yourself? Why not just bow to convention? Well, that's a serious question. Why not just bow to convention? I think these things are important. I just think somehow I'd like to know why it's so painful for us to not shave our legs.
Do you think that the mainstream sensibility of the time is contagious, and that even if you don't think makeup is important, if everybody's wearing it, and the image of being good looking that's currently available or currently being marketed has makeup, that you somehow get it in your system, that's what you need to do to look good?
Oh, it happens to us so fast, of course. I mean, you see the ads, you see the made-up face. I remember when the cosmetics companies stopped pushing the natural look, which they had to do for us, right, in the 60s and 70s. They were pushing the natural look. So today it's no longer natural. It's as artificial as you want it to be. And at first I'd look at those pictures of the made-up women, and I thought they looked clownish, absolutely clownish. You know, a few years later, I've internalized it again. I look at those faces. They're so bright and, you know, all that glitz and glitter. That's what the feminine face is supposed to look like today. I look in the mirror at my own face, and I feel washed out, washed out. And I know, because I talk to the women who do rely on cosmetics now, they feel their faces are inadequate when they look in the mirror. They feel they need the cosmetics in order to just have that competitive edge.
What does that say, that people don't feel good without putting on cosmetics? Because cosmetics, well, people say, gee, I feel so good when I wear it. So you figure, well great, then you should wear it. But what does it say that they don't feel good without it?
I think it says something very tragic about women in our natural state, that we have accepted the judgment that our natural bodies, with the hair that grows where it grows, our skin coloring with all its blotches, whatever, the pimples that are here and there, the blackheads, somehow that this is unfit to be seen by men and by other women too. And to look in the mirror first thing in the morning is to be overcome with feelings of insecurity and even hatred for yourself. And it goes, of course, beyond the face, the body too. Did you read that new Glamour magazine survey? The Glamour magazine did a study asking what women cared about the most in life. The obsession was with losing weight. The study showed that they cared about losing weight more than they cared about success at work or even a date with an interesting man that they admired. Somehow American women have bought the notion that if only they could knock off 10 pounds, or maybe it's only 2 pounds, their lives are going to change, romance will come into it, they will be able to face the world and capture the world. And it just fills up our heads with all kinds of strange stuff.
Susan Brownmiller is my guest, and her new book is called Femininity. And in it, you write that you have made some concessions in spite of how you theoretically feel, and one of them is that you color your hair.
Sure do. It's also fairly set today. I was in Washington yesterday, and I had to do a late-night television show network, and I panicked because my hair is always messy in its natural state. Now it's hot. It's great, too, in its natural state, but we don't let that show. So so I asked the hotel if they could possibly have a hairdresser come to my room before I went on national television, because I couldn't face that large audience and have people look at me and say, she's talking about femininity, look at her hair. Yeah, so anyway, it's still holding its set. I think he put some spray on it, some spray. Don't you think it looks feminine, Terry?
what goes through your mind when you're deciding what's worth making a concession for? Because, yeah, on the one hand, well, a lot of this has to do with self-consciousness, which is probably at the root of what we do to make ourselves feminine anyways, because if everybody was perfectly satisfied with the way they looked, they wouldn't bother to spend the time and the money on cosmetics and hairstylists and
I don't think
and clothes. Though there is a certain like pleasure in costuming, mm-hmm. you know, in the transformation that you can get.
And there is a transformation. I mean, there is no doubt that everything a woman puts on is a costume in some form or another, and it's fun to dress up and to play with roles.
Can you go through the pro and con that you do, the dialogue with yourself that you go through?
On which job, you name it. Well, let's conduct the dialogue.
Okay.
Hands, feet, breasts, stomach, you know. The conflicts, yes, are right there.
Let's do hair.
Hair. Well, I've been at, I say in my book, I've been at odds with the hair on my head all of my life. I mean, I know where it came from. Well, first of all, you can't have gone to a Hollywood movie. I mean, I grew up with Veronica Lake was the big sex symbol when I grew up in the 40s and 50s and started to go to movies. And Veronica, of course, I mean, Life magazine did 5 features on Veronica's hair just before the outbreak of Pearl Harbor. And, I mean, they would tell you the number of hairs in her head, how long it was in the front, how long it was in the back. I mean, there was a crisis once. She was smoking a cigarette and she singed her golden treasure. I mean, this was reported in the newspapers. I was 7 years old when the movie I Married a Witch played at the Kent Theater in Brooklyn, where I was growing up. I saw that movie and I wanted to be Veronica Lake. Now, I have dark hair. Mm-hmm. I don't look like Veronica Lake at all. The first thing I did was, well, I didn't do it when I was 7, but when I got to, I don't even think it was high school. I think it was still public school. I bleached the front of my hair with peroxide. In fact, it became the rage in the school. I think another woman, Alice Glantz, did it before I did. You know, so all of a sudden, all the girls in school were bleaching the front of their hair to be a little blonde. Now, that was my first hair insecurity. Oh, maybe it was earlier when I wanted to wear the loose flowing hair like Veronica, and my mother said, no, you have to wear your hair in pigtails. Anyway, it started early, my feeling that my hair wasn't good enough. Good enough. Yeah, and what is good enough? It covers the scalp. You know, I mean, what's good enough? I had hair. I still have hair. I'm not bald. More men go bald than women. That's genetic. That's real. But as a child, I knew my hair wasn't good enough. When I started to work in offices, and you know, in my 20s, I placed myself in permanent bondage to Elizabeth Arden. You know, a phrase I use in my book. There was a time in my life when I swear I would go to Elizabeth Arden twice a week. I was working in a Madison Avenue office, a magazine, and I felt that everyone else in that office looked so terrific. I mean, maybe they were good at pin curls and rollers. I was never good at that at school. You know, I failed in pin curls and rollers. So I took myself to a professional. And with each style change, I had the new look because that's what the hairdresser would give me. And I had a problem with every look. There was something, particularly the blunt cut. Do you remember the blunt cut? Yes, the hair had to be straight and shaped at the same time. And I have these wayward waves and my hair would simply not be blunted. And even the hairdresser gave up on that one.
But so, the decision not to color your hair, I can see you really being at odds with yourself about that. That you know, on the one hand, what's wrong with having hair that's slightly gray? On the other hand, if you want hair with color in it, why not color it?
Well, if you're a feminist and with a reputation as a fierce feminist and you look at men with gray hair and no one says they don't look good, and in fact, a man with gray hair looks distinguished. I mean, it's a sign of maturity. Why were people telling me that I didn't look good anymore? And men did. I mean, men really. Well, women too. But I mean, they'd pull me over and say, Susan, you know, you used to look a lot better. And you've got to, I don't know if you're aware of it, but your hair is getting very gray. Do something about it. Well, I didn't know what to do. But a good friend of mine came over to the house one Christmas, and she really poured a bottle of loving care over my head. I looked in the mirror and she said, look at yourself. The gray is gone. It's easy. It's so easy to color your hair. So I began to do the loving care. And guess what? I felt more relaxed about my hair. I really did. I mean, that was a compromise that I felt I had to make. Now, I think in another 10, 20 years or so, I hope I can stop dyeing my hair. I don't want to be a woman in her late 70s with the jet black hair or the, you know, the dark hair. I mean, there's got to be a time to cut it off. But at this point, in my 40s, I felt I needed that competitive edge. See, that's why I understand femininity as so competitive, because no one is more competitive than I am. And I think that competitive women in particular are aware of the competitive aspects of femininity and do what they have to do, and even do more than they have to do. I'm somewhere in between, but I think I see it.
I get the impression from your book that dress reform has been an important part of every wave of feminism in history. Because a lot of people might be thinking, oh, this is pretty trivial, isn't it? You know, talking about clothes and hair and things like that. But historically, it's It's pretty significant, wouldn't
you say?
Everything
that women do is considered trivial by men, as they make us do it. And they do. I mean, they don't tell us that the gloves have to match the coat. I mean, women go further than what men say, you know, we're supposed to do. But when you start to get obsessed with it, boy, there's no end to the obsession. And certainly feminists in other generations, including Joan of Arc, let's start with her, have been up against the question of appropriate dress for women. And feminists have always fallen on this issue because there are some subjects that you just simply can't resolve by theory. Some things speak too much to the inner needs for approval, the need to be attractive, and the need to feel secure within your own gender identity. And certainly clothes rank high on that list.
Susan Brownmiller is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, Femininity. You're probably also familiar with her first book, Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape. Well, now that there's a lot of women in executive positions and, you know, middle management positions, there's the whole dress for success corporate look. And there's lots of books of advice telling women how they should dress. I have an example here. As a matter of fact, I thought I'd read a selection from it. And this is a selection from a book called Before You Say a Word by Miles Martell. And this is a chapter for the female executive. It says, fashion consultants advise that female executives acknowledge that fashion and femininity are inappropriate in the office. At the same time, women must guard against projecting too masculine an image. Therefore, a conservative wardrobe that will win respect rather than admiration belongs in the closet of the successful businesswoman. And some of the advice... The female equivalent of the man's business suit is a matching skirted suit. The cut of the suit should be full and not designed to exaggerate the figure. The traditionally designed man-tailored jacket is best. Skirts should look comfortable, not confining, and their length should be just below the knee. Vests are also too great a concession to fashion and should be avoided since their tight fit accentuates the bust line, especially when worn without a jacket. It advises not to wear a pinstripe since that projects a masculine image. And not to wear pastels because that's very feminine.
Yeah, but the warning signs are really there, aren't they? In all directions, beyond this line, thou shalt not go.
What's happening here with the corporate look and women being advised to wear the equivalent of the male suit and not to do anything that would call attention to their bust line?
I think it's a hoot.
At the same time that all the femininity stuff is returning.
Yeah. Well, I. I feel very sorry for women who have bought these books and who are now and a lot of women are now dressing in this fashion. The Saint Laurie look, I think, is the famous suit look for the executive woman. What's interesting to me about it is that there's the attempt above the waist, actually above the kneecaps, to hide femaleness. I mean, it's fascinating, he said, you know, obscure the bust line. I mean, we have breasts. We have breasts of different sizes, some small, some large. Whatever it is, it's female. I mean, this is one of our identifying characteristics. But apparently, in order to succeed on the corporate level and to project credibility and competence, we must put on the male costume on top, more or less. I mean, it's you know, you take out the padded shoulder, although they did try the padded shoulder look for the last few years. But you want a kind of tailored masculine jacket on top to project your male aspect. You are now capable of making executive decisions. But you can't go too far with this. So when you get below the knee there, you want the cutoff. You want the skirt to show your traditional femininity, and you want to show your legs because men don't show their legs, and you need, of course, the shaved leg and the nylon stocking. And I don't know if he says it or not, but women certainly have returned to the high-heeled shoe. I think for maximum comfort, I prefer to wear the pants, which I think are more comfortable, and, you know, to wear whatever you want on top and not to disguise the fact that you have breasts, because for goodness sakes, you're a woman, you have them. Why are men so freaked by this? Why are women so freaked by this? Yeah.
While we're on the subject of breasts, let's talk about them some more. You make a really interesting point about, well, we all know that sizes of breasts go in and out of fashion. One year you're supposed to be flat-chested, and another year you're supposed to be really buxom. And what connections have you found to what's happening in society and the breast size that's
fashionable? Well, yes, I feel this is one of the most original points I make in the book. You are the first person who has had the nerve to ask to talk about breasts in public here. It's amazing how all the reviews have none of them have mentioned breasts. And I did think that it was very interesting when I wrote about it. It seemed to me, when I traced it back, I mean, to the 50s, when I grew up and you were supposed to have the big bosom, this was a very conservative time in American culture when women were celebrated for staying at home. And Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield with the super breasts were what we all should look like. I, as a fairly small-breasted woman, of course, wore a padded bra, one of those push-up bras, because that was in fashion at the time. Now, my mother, who was more amply endowed, you see, had grown up in the 20s, which was a time of greater liberation for women, when the look was no breasts or small breasts, and my mother, being full, had to bind her breasts to fit into the fashion. So you can't win if you just have the body that you have. You know, you've got to fit in. But anyway, there I was in the 50s, so uncomfortable because I had small breasts and with the padded bra. And in the 60s, it got a little easier so I could take out the padding. In the late 60s, I could throw away the bra entirely because the no bra look came in. And I had never needed a bra at all, ever, ever. Hooray! I did away with it. Contrary to popular misconception, no feminist ever burned a bra. That's just one of the myths we've had to live with. Well, I remain braless today. But, you know, I am small-breasted, and it's easier for me to go without a bra. And I had to listen really closely to friends of mine who had bigger breasts and who said, listen, when I run for the bus, I jiggle, and I need some support. And oh, is that interesting to think that the female body standing up, you know, on two legs, this evolutionary adaptation does mean that large-breasted women are not going to be able to run freely because breasts do slap against the chest wall, and it can be uncomfortable. Even I sometimes have been on a horse, you know, and if you don't know how to post and you're jogging up and down and the horse is jogging the other way and you're, you know, slam, slam, slamming, even I sometimes have sort of wanted to hold my breasts to just stop the motion because it can be uncomfortable. And then I thought, oh, perhaps that was one of the reasons why women went for the corset for all those centuries, because although when we hear about the corset, we hear a lot about nipping in the waistline in the middle, the real purpose of that corset was to hold the breasts in a fairly stationary manner. So breasts maybe have always been a problem for women. And wow, that's biological and anatomical. And are big breasts one of the many things that have slowed women down in life? Is that why in the 50s, when they wanted to slow women down, they said, wow, it's the big breasts that are the celebrated breasts? And then in the 20s and in the late 60s and 70s, when women were on the move, fast and furious, we can do anything, suddenly it was the small-breasted woman who was in fashion? And what does it mean today when Marielle Hemingway puts in the silicone implants? Ooh, yeah, yeah. Are we returning again to the big breast fetish? But and is it part of the return to femininity? Does it mean that next year we're going to be back in the kitchen? It's interesting, isn't it?
She, on the other hand, though, did it for a role. Not she did it to get the role in Star 80, and not just because she wanted to look that way. And at the same time, a lot of women are getting their breasts reduced through the counterpart form of surgery.
Yeah, on the East Coast, when I talked to plastic surgeons, they said that the trend on the East Coast is toward reductions, and I think that's because of the fast-moving pace. But in California, they have always gone and still go in for the augmentations, as did Asian women during the Vietnam War who worked as prostitutes for American GIs. They also pumped silicone into their breasts to be more appealing.
There have been a lot of crazy styles for men and women, and you can see it in history books or in art galleries if you're looking at paintings from other centuries. And looking back, the men's clothes look as preposterous to us as the women's do, with the
Cod pieces.
Thanks. Yeah.
The stock. You know, there was a time when men exposed their legs. I mean, the exposure of female legs has been very recent, but throughout history, men's legs were exposed, and they wore white cotton wool stockings, and they, you know, they put pads into the calf part of the stocking to make it look like they had a larger bulge in the calf muscle.
But a difference you point out, though, is that men's clothes never hurt.
Right.
Or never constricted your movement like women's clothes
for women. Yeah, except for the upper classes. The kings and queens, but particularly the kings, wore immobilizing garments because they, and this is the interesting class part of femininity, you know, where economics and the aristocracy fits into the mix, that the kings wanted to project not only drama, but also the fact that they did not have to pick up anything for themselves. The world catered to them. They had servants. So their clothes could be immobile. They could have the billowing sleeve, the white ruff around the neck of the lace, you know, perishable lace, which showed that they were members of the upper class and others labored for them. I found that what was an upper class standard for men in one century would become the feminine standard for women in later centuries.
Hmm. Yeah. Susan Brown Miller is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, Femininity. On the one hand, women are expected to look good and to spend the time that's necessary to get the right cosmetics and clothes and hairdo and accessories. On the other hand, they're criticized for being vain, for spending the time on all of that. What do you make of that contradiction?
Well, it's one of the thousands of contradictions that make up for the feminine aesthetic. Anyone with any Marxist background should really love to look at femininity because it is filled with conflict and contradiction. And where does it resolve? I don't know, but I like to use the dialectic to explore these things. I adore it as a fascinating contradiction that a woman who spends no time or a minimal amount of time on her clothes is considered unfeminine. And to be feminine, one must absolutely devote oneself to inconsequential details on a serious basis. And then, of course, the charge will be made contemptuously that you are vain, that you are superficial, that your mind is constantly distracted by irrelevancies. And do you mind if I keep talking for a minute? Because I know. All right. Well, then let me say that I, when I was talking in my book about feminine speech and feminine emotion, I mentioned that the speech of women is filled with sudden crises that are inexplicable to men. All kinds of emotional upsets, like I've got a run in my stocking, or. Yeah, I chipped a nail, or I'm getting a pimple. I mean, these are genuine crises to women because we are obsessed with these things because we know these things are important because men judge us by these things. So, of course, we think about them, and, of course, to get a pimple on your chin is such a setback for a woman. I mean, it is, Sartre, even, you know, in No Exit, he has a very funny scene between Estelle and the other woman. And when one of the women wants to throw the other woman off stride, she says, oh, what is that on your face? A pimple. Yeah, well, pimples have loomed large in my life, let me tell you. And I love chocolate, and I'm trying not to eat it on this book tour because my face breaks out instantly. I mean, you'd think that an author could have a pimple and it wouldn't speak to the credibility of her work. It probably would speak to the credibility of my work. Thanks for laughing. I mean, otherwise I might sound like a very obsessed woman, but I mean, I do try to see the humor in it. As I try to see it, and I understand these kinds. I understand. I was in the elevator in my own apartment building, and this young woman turned to the guy she was with, and she said, "I just broke a nail." And he looked at her with concern because he knew she was in pain. But you know, it was very hard for him to understand the tragedy of a broken nail. But I could see it from her point of view. I mean, she'd worked very hard to grow those things.
There's another way I think that this is being explained now, which is that men too are really dressing up and going to hairstylists, and men are stripping at bars now. You know, it's not just women who have to maintain these standards and have to keep up their appearances, i.e. to be professional, you have to look good. Anyone on TV shouldn't have a pimple, man or woman. Men wear makeup on TV.
Sure.
So that's been one of the kind of equalizers that mm-hmm. that are being offered now, you know, that men have to get their hair styled, men have to wear good clothes, look good, keep up appearances.
They can cry too now.
That's right. But do you think that is equalizing things? Because maybe it's unfair at this point to call having to pay attention to appearance feminine. Maybe it's something that's being required or something of interest to men and women equally now.
Mm. Well, I think in that sense, people in show business are often pioneers, because I remember the first time I did a rock story in the 60s. I interviewed a group called Paul Revere and the Raiders, I think it was. And I went to their hotel room at the Pierre or wherever, and they weren't ready to be interviewed. And my God, all these guys were blow drying their hair, teasing it, and spraying it. I had never seen men do that. I mean, by that time, I was used to seeing long haired men. But by the way, I when I first saw men with long hair, you know, I reacted to that traditional conservative way. What are they doing? What are they doing? These men with long hair, they should cut their hair and be men, you know. But I got to like it. I got to love the long hair. I mean, I wish men would keep that long hair. I think they look terrific with it. It was interesting to see that some of them had terrific hair, by the way, and some of them looked messy like me. but to see a man blow dry and spray his hair to look good for an audience is really revelation. And these were straight men, I mean, by the way, which is really, really interesting. And, I guess he'll never hear about it, so I can tell this little anecdote. My publisher told me that David Frost wrote a book a few years ago for Simon & Schuster and went on his publicity tour, and he told them that he insisted on having a personal hairdresser in the hotel room at 8 o'clock every morning. And they looked at him in horror. That he said, listen, I have to face the public. My hair isn't as good as it looks on television. I don't know how to handle it myself, he said. I need a professional to tease it and spray it and blow it, you know, and just make it look good. And, oh, I had all this new sympathy for David Frost, because I'm one of these women, too, who need a professional to handle her hair. I'd like to send it out and have it come back, actually.
So maybe it doesn't have that much to do with femininity anymore. Maybe it's just more societal.
There are a lot of men out there who think that any man who teases or sprays his hair is not a man. I mean, you know what's manly and what's not manly in those old traditions. Some of them are passing. Some of them are still with us. I don't know how far it'll go. I don't know if Boy George and David Bowie are going to lead a new generation of men into the Revlon cosmetics racket and sell another $1 million worth of cosmetics. I don't think so. There's a little bit of crossover. People are playing a bit with androgyny today. But, you know, the history of femininity has gone on for thousands of years, and I don't think that what a couple of rock stars do is that significant, although it's interesting and should be noted. Yeah.
So you think that this fashion craze has a worse effect on women than men? What's the effect? If you want to feminine and if you're going in for all the latest stuff, what do you think is the problem with that? Is it inhibiting? How does it change your behavior?
I think that you'll have to put a lot of energy into it. I think that's why I don't like it. There are parts of femininity that I do easily, and so those are the parts that I concentrate on. I feel that I use my body. I move around. I wriggle and squirm, and I hope move in graceful ways. That's something I've done from childhood, and I feel I do it without thinking about it, and I feel I don't need a high-heeled shoe to do it or a skirt to do it. I feel I can kind of move in a feminine fashion, without those props. But I've been doing that all my life. Other women feel more confident about their femininity if they put on earrings or makeup or a skirt or the stockings, or if they say, I'm not ambitious. Now, I'm not ambitious is a serious one. I'm not willing to say that. Of course, one easy way to prove your femininity is to say you're not a feminist, right? That's really easy. You say, who, me? I'm not a feminist. I'm feminine. And you'll get some applause for that.
Yeah. I'm talking to Susan Brownmiller, and Femininity is the name of her new book. I don't know if you thought about this or not, but, you know, a lot of men are attending at the births of their children, and they're getting to see their wife's body in a way that they never have before. I mean, they're getting to see the vagina perform as the canal for childbirth, as opposed to that mysterious seat of sensuality in a woman that is hidden and dark and all the descriptions, you know.
Favorable and unfavorable. Yeah, we don't need to labor this point. Yes.
And people will, after childbirth, talk really openly about whether they've had an episiotomy or not. And, you know, what effects it's had on their body. People breastfeed in public. And all the kind of mysterious parts of a woman's sensuality, the functional parts are being discussed in the open. So there's like the two aspects side by side.
There always are in the culture at any given time, you know?
But it hasn't been that open before, I
not
think.
Not on femaleness.
Mysterious and hidden. What effect do you think
I think
that's
it's
having?
Had a terrific effect. Because femaleness is who we really, you know, what we really are, and the femininity part is the real mystery, and that's the illusion. Those are the temporary, ephemeral effects that any woman knows, you know, are put on and can be taken off. And see, I've seen women try to breastfeed in public, and I've seen the response from other people that isn't altogether favorable. You know, there are sometimes, there have been cases of, there was one woman who went to a public pool and breastfed her child. And the people at the pool, imagine, in their bikinis and in their trunks, men and women, were mortified by this woman breastfeeding. Because in our culture, breasts are not primarily thought of as how a mother nurses her young. They're thought of as delectable sexual objects for the attention and also the criticism of men. I'm sorry to keep quoting my own book, but I mean, I primarily think on the typewriter, so some of my lines I'm fond of. Oh, what was the line I was so fond of? It just flew out of my head. I say that a girl child grows up knowing that breasts belong to everybody. They breasts are both intimate, private property on the woman's body, but they also have this public aspect. Others comment on them. Parents comment, oh, she's growing breasts. Oh, she's not growing breasts. Boyfriends comment on it. Girlfriends compare. People on the street feel free to make comments about women's breasts. It's very hard, I imagine, to feel at ease with your body when there's so much discussion. And do you know, I was so glad that you brought up breasts on this program, because I had to really take a deep breath and compose myself before I dared to write about breasts in my book. Because who writes about breasts in this society? It's men. Men write about women's breasts. How can a woman dare to write about women's breasts? I mean, we only have them, right? But for us to have opinions about them, to say that, the only place where women feel comfortable writing about breasts is, unfortunately, to write about breast cancer and fibroids, and things like that. But to discuss breasts and to discuss what I call the containerization of breasts, you know, the brassieres and what that's meant, and how the brassiere stands alone as a sex object without the woman in it. When I was at college, you know, grab the brassiere, run it up the flagpole. We, you know, it was like the panty raids or swallowing goldfish in the 20s. I mean, brassieres have a sexual life of their own off the woman's body, not to mention on the woman's body. Why is it there are so many men who think a woman's body looks better with the brassiere on rather than off? Very interesting stuff.
You know, that reminds me that there seems to be a return to really erotic lace
underwear,
yeah.
Lingerie.
And I've asked several people about it, you know, people who market it and stuff, and they say, well, you know, professional women, they're wearing this dress for success type uniform, conservative clothes, and they want to maintain some of their femininity so that they know underneath they're still really a woman.
Right, and so it's the black lace lingerie that's going to make them really feel like a woman instead of who they are. We are women, for goodness sakes. It's amazing how all of us can have our gender threatened. I mean, the words she's not feminine. I mean, that strikes such a chill in me because I know what they're saying. They're saying I'm not a woman. They're saying I'm not heterosexual. They're saying so much stuff. And how can they say that? How can they say that? I am a woman. Why do I have to keep proving it and proving it and proving it in these kinds of ways? But, I mean, the black lingerie, I mean, I thought a lot of, and I wrote a bit about how black lacy lingerie came to be considered so sexy. And I decided that the lingerie itself, of course, is a crisscross of impediments. I mean, you know, it's the bra and the really sexy stuff in the porn magazines, of course. You know, you don't wear pantyhose. You wear the garter belt and with those tabs and those short stockings. The pornography genre, men are still attached to the garter belt because it is such a curious, impediment. It's such a weird... weird item of clothes. I used to wear a garter belt, actually, in the 50s to hold up my nylon stockings with the seams. The seams are also considered sexy, right? Oh, straight. Are your seams straight? Oh, yes. But why black? And I decided that while we are, our bodies are considered more sexy when they are contained and we are more inhibited, the black of it, you know, the blackness of it and that lace, it's concealment, it's flirtation, and it's also an assertiveness that we are not supposed to have in ourselves. You know, the black lingerie becomes the self-assertion that the woman herself can't assert. It's a marvelous triple bind, double bind, not to mention the real bind of the uncomfortableness of wearing these garments, wearing them. Hmm.
Talking with Susan Brown-Miller, and her new book is called Femininity. I'd like to spend a couple of minutes doing an update on your 1975 book, Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape, which again was the first book to say rape is not an act of sexual lust, it's an act of violence. Do you think that that society has changed much in its attitude towards rape here in America since the publication of that book?
Partially. There was a whole women's movement that talked about rape in addition to my book. So I don't want anyone to think that I think that my book, you know, caused whatever changes have been made. My book was, certainly a contributing factor. I would have thought that we were further along if that South Carolina judge hadn't called a couple of months ago for castration for rapists. And I thought, oh, the message hasn't reached South Carolina. Here's this guy still thinking that rape is a crime of uncontrollable lust. And he is suggesting that we have the surgical operation, remove the testicles, and that'll stop the crime of rape. It doesn't work, first of all. And it's such old thinking. I thought we were beyond it, but apparently we aren't. Certain phrases that I said in Against Our Will and that others have said have moved into the popular culture, and one of them is rape is not a crime of sex, it's a crime of power. It is also a crime of sex. You know, it is. It uses the sex organs, and for men, it is also considered a sexy thing to do, in addition to the demonstration of power. But that subtlety got lost a little, and I was in the curious position once of talking to a group of women about pornography, which I do feel that pornography is a contributing factor to that climate of opinion in the nation, which makes young men feel that it is a testament to manhood to rape because they see it in pornography. So I was trying to explain this to a group of women, and one of them got up and said, "Excuse me, Miss Brown-Miller, I thought that rape was a crime not of lust and sex but of power, so why are you saying that pornography is a contributory factor?" So it seems to me that people absorb things slowly and incompletely, in our society. I hope that people can understand that rape is indeed an assaultive act that is a crime of power and has less to do with sex than we used to think. But they can also understand that pornography, with its distortions of the meaning of sex, can contribute to a fellow deciding that to rape is a testament to his sexuality and masculinity. So, you know, a little progress, but not enough progress to suit me.
I'm not going to get this quote exactly right, but one of the lines in the book is that rape is a crime that all men...
Mm-hmm. A conscious problem. I know it. It's been thrown back at me a lot. Rape is. I try to avoid that in femininity. There's no one sentence femininity is. I wasn't going to make that mistake 8 years later. The sentence reads, and against our will, rape is a conscious process of intimidation by which all men keep all women in a state of fear. And this was, I feel, misinterpreted by some intelligent men and women to mean that all men are rapists or that there was a conspiracy among men to rape. That was not the intention of that sentence. If that is the general perception of that sentence, then I did a poor job as a writer and I communicated something I didn't mean to communicate. I didn't need to write a 485-page book that said all men are rapists. I know many men are not rapists. Many men could not, would not think to harm another human being. What I meant was that all men benefit from the act of rape because some men rape. And I say that very clearly in the book, that rapists are the myrmidons in our culture. Rapists are the shock troops for the others. And because all women must live in fear because it can happen to any of us because of our structural vulnerability and the male physical capacity to rape, there are benefits to all men. And anyone who remembers the history of lynching in the American South knows that only some white men may have lynched some blacks, but nevertheless, all blacks lived in a state of fear, and there were benefits to all white people because some men lynched. And I think that analogy holds up for rape.
What do you think is the main work ahead for the women's movement now? Like, what are the issues that you consider to be the most important?
I wouldn't want to put a priority on issues because I concentrate on some of the sex issues and the human relations issues. Other women concentrate on equal pay for equal work or equal pay for not equal work, for the different kinds of work that women must do because who is taking care of those kids? Others feel that, it's important to have more women run for office. Abortion, my goodness. I mean, we can lose everything we've gained. I mean, boy, are they organized out there against us. I would not put priorities on it. I think that we all simply have to do what we enjoy doing the most and not ever forget that, we're in it to change the world and make the world better. But for goodness sakes, we ought to really like what we're doing. And I like what I'm doing. I organize sometimes. I have a lot of problems, actually, when I work as an organizer in the women's movement. It's difficult. It's difficult to be a leader of women. And the women's movement is not. It's another discussion. It's another subject. But I feel very comfortable writing. I feel very comfortable exploring the complexities of a subject like femininity. I enjoyed exploring the history of rape, which had never been written. But I wouldn't say that what I do is more important than what other women choose to do. What we all have to do is hold hands and stand firm, because I think we're in a holding pattern now. Yeah. It's a little scary. We could possibly lose everything we've gained. It's happened before. Things never quite go back to the way they were. But it seems to me that the progress of civilization also includes a step back for every two steps forward. And I think it is not as easy to be a feminist in 1984 as it was in 1974. It's also... makes a lot of us tired, burnout. Personal relationships are very important. You know, feminists never denied it. But somehow many people think that to be concerned with your personal relationships means that you must turn away from those all-women's meetings. So these are difficult times.
Well, I really regret we're out of time. I'd love to talk some more. But I want to thank you a lot for doing the show today. Thanks for being
here.
Well,
listen, I will tell you that this was the best conversation I have had so far on the subject of my new book, and you are terrific.
Oh, thanks.
You're great.
I really enjoy this. Susan Brown Miller has been my guest, and if you want to read her new book, it's called Femininity. It's published by the Linden Press. The title, again, is Femininity, and she's also the author of Against Our Will, the classic feminist analysis of rape that was published in 1975.